You're listening to Wake Up Tucson. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
All right, let's get going on this Hoot Nanny. 7:07 in the morning, you're on the Wake Up Tucson show, 10:30 The Voice, local news and talk. I'm with my good friend Matt Neely today. Matthew, thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. If you miss anything, KVOI.com. The Ed Alexander retirement party has been rescheduled to the new year, so you will get a refund back from Wendy at Chef Chic. And then at the same time, what was the other thing I was going to tell you? Oh, we are raising money for Ed's retirement trip to Italy. So please go to GoFundMe.com, go to the top left, hit retirement trip, Ed Alexander, Italy, and then it'll pop up, and please give what you can.
It's a really nice retirement gift, and, you know, everybody kind of pulling in the same direction. You can, you know, create a memory.
Yeah, give him something he'll always remember. So absolutely. All right, we got to go right to the phones. The book is called The Life and Deaths of Cyril Wecht, Memoirs of America's Most Controversial Forensic Pathologist. He has been called upon in several high-profile cases, including the deaths of JFK, RFK, ML, Martin Luther King, Elvis, JonBenet Ramsey, Lacey Peterson. This guy must, and he's still 39 years old, like Jack Benny.
Look at that. Nicole Smith, too, and her son.
Dr. Weck, good morning.
Good morning, Chris and Matthew. I hope you're both well. Thank you for having me on your program.
So why are you America's most controversial?
Well, it's the cases that are controversial, and I've just had the wonderful opportunity to become involved as a consultant in those cases over the years, beginning back in 1965, 66 with John F. Kennedy assassination, and continuing on through the present time, the cases that you mentioned, and throw in some more, O.J. Simpson, Waco, Branch Davidian Fire, Menendez Brothers, Secretary of Commerce Ron Brown, White House Counsel Vincent Foster, Gene Harris, Klaus Rambullo case, Phil Spector. So these cases are or were interesting, challenging from a medical legal standpoint, and people love to talk about it. I have the opportunity to speak to groups, many kinds of people, age groups, professional, academic, people always want to talk about these cases.
Looking back at your career, I mean, with all these things, what's the common thread? I mean, what was your niche in these cases? It seems like it might have been chain of custody that might have been kind of your specialty area.
No, that's been one thing. No, well, my niche has been functioning as a forensic pathologist. And everybody knows now from television programs, beginning with Quincy, I guess, about three, 4 decades, and continuing on through CSI and so on, what the forensic pathologist does. And sometimes it begins with going to the scene, and then most importantly, in the performance of the autopsy, or in many cases in which I've been involved, I've done second autopsies, and then reviewing autopsies, as well as everything else that goes with it, the microscopic slides, the toxicological results, police investigator reports, other investigator reports, eyewitness accounts, and so on. And putting it all together and then dealing with it and trying to come up with the honest answer. The common denominator is approaching these things in an objective, unbiased fashion, dealing with it in a strict forensic scientific fashion, and applying the basic principles that this should not vary from one case to another insofar as honesty and objectivity are concerned.
So when you do a second, when you're called in to do a second autopsy, what are some of the common things that you have found that aren't done in the first, or not done correctly, or not, maybe they're not being looked for in the first autopsy?
Well, they have varied greatly from sometimes something as basic as a pathologist's failure to open up the head. I even had a case like that involving a college student outside Pittsburgh where they made a ruling and missed the entirety, the essence of the case by not examining the head. But most times it's because they have not interpreted the results correctly, or they had done so in a biased fashion. What does happen many times is that these pathologists are influenced, not in some kind of conspiratorial fashion, but just by virtue of the ambiance, people with whom they work, and so on, by law enforcement agencies and sometimes by other governmental agencies in arriving at answers that are simply not correct. And the prime example of that is, of course, the John F. Kennedy assassination. The Warren Commission report is sheer, absolute, unadulterated nonsense. And that's because the pathologists who did the autopsy had never done a gunshot wound autopsy in their entire careers. I want to repeat that. I want American citizens, including some individuals who still believe in the Warren Commission, to know that here we have the President of the United States, let's say it was John Jones in Tucson or Bob Smith here in Pittsburgh, and multiple gunshot wounds. You got to differentiate entrance from exit. You got to determine angle and sequence trajectory. Then you got to correlate those wounds with wounds in Governor Connally to see what might be related and so on. And so we're going to call upon, in this great, magnificent country of ours, two guys who are career naval pathologists who will act under the orders of four-star admirals and generals, and we're going to ask them to do this autopsy. It is absolutely incredible. It's insulting, and it angers me, even now today as I speak to you for the 10,000th time or whatever. Just thinking about it, really, really, I can't tell you how upsetting this is to me.
This is the whole magic bullet thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah, the single bullet 30. One bullet producing seven wounds and two men going into Kennedy, begin with entering his back, moving upward at an angle of 11.5 degrees, having been fired from the 6-4 window, supposedly under their theory of the Texas School Book Depository building, exiting from the president's throat, moving then downward and to the left, turns in midair, swings over to the right about 18, 20 inches, hits Governor Connally behind the right armpit, goes through the chest, pierces the lung, destroys 4 inches of the right fifth rib, exits from below his chest, then sweeps up and around another 10, 12 inches to re-enter the back of his right wrist, shattering the distal end of the radius, one of the two bones from the elbow to the wrist, exits from the wrist, re-enters his left thigh, and then somehow, fortuitously, not noticed by anybody, working on him, the governor saving his life, a maintenance man trying to get to the men's room later on at Parkland Hospital in Dallas, finds the corridor blocked by stretchers, bends down, and lo and behold, there is this bullet. Near pristine, a 6.5 millimeter copper jacket, a lead core piece of military ammunition, jacket, the nose, the cone completely intact with a weight loss of only 1.5%, despite having left pieces of itself in four anatomical locations of the two men. And that is a single bullet theory upon which the Warren Commission report's conclusion is based regarding a sole assassin. It's a sine qua non of the Warren Commission report. If you don't have a single bullet theory, you automatically must have two shooters.
If you remember the Kevin Costner did this in the movie, it's because Dr. Cyril actually consulted on that flick. Now, so when were you brought in relation to the Warren Commission?
Well, I got started by giving a talk at the American Academy of Forensic Sciences in 66, and then I became involved with all kinds of programs. And so my next official involvement was when District Attorney Jim Garrison consulted me in the Clay Shaw trial. And I testified before a federal judge trying to gain access to the autopsy materials. The judge so ruled. The government said they would appeal. Garrison had to proceed with the case. And I did that, which was painful, but it was morally and ethically proper. I said, I'm sorry, I can't testify because I haven't seen the autopsy report. Finally, in 1972, which is a long story in itself, I got in as the first non-government-related, non-government-sponsored forensic pathologist to study all the autopsy materials at the National Archives, everything, a rifle, gun, bullets, fragments, x-rays, photos, and so on. And I reported at that time, by the way, August 24, 1972, look up front page New York Times by Fred Graham, their top reporter at that time, that the president's brain was missing. The doctors at the autopsy did what they had to do, place the brain in formalin to harden it so that it would get a better consistency to be examined. And 2 weeks later, they went back, and the autopsy report says sections of the brain are not made in order to preserve the specimen. Preserve the specimen? What, for Jackie Kennedy's mantelpiece? What are you? And so that brain, as we talk here today, has never been accounted for and remains missing.
That sounds like something out of a sci-fi movie. The president's brain is missing.
Yeah, if you read it in a book, you'd say, this is absurd. Who the hell is going to believe this?
Now, Dr. Weck, can we keep you for one more segment if possible?
Yeah, sure, I'd be happy.
All right, now I got one question before we go to break. How did President Kennedy actually die?
Oh, he died because of the massive head injuries. That's why he died.
But how did that happen?
Well, he was shot in the head twice, once from the rear and once from the front. One shooter was behind the picket fence on the grassy knoll, and another shooter from the rear.
And the shooter from the rear, was that Lee Harvey Oswald in the Texas Book Depository?
Well, that remains in question. But, you know, I never get hung up on that, because what I want is a second shooter, because that makes it a conspiracy. And under the laws of your state and the other 49 states and the federal government, two or more people acting to plan, execute, cover up a crime makes it a conspiracy. And that means the case has to be reopened. So whether it was Oswald or not, I personally don't believe Oswald was a shooter. But that's not essential, you know, to my critique of the Warren Commission report.
All right, Dr. Weck, please hold on for a few commercials, please.
Yes.
Thank you, sir. We're talking, the book is called The Life and Deaths of Cyril Weck, Memoirs of America's Most Controversial Forensic Pathologist. Wake up, Tucson, 10:30 The Voice. All right, welcome back to the Wake Up Tucson show. Christy Simone, Matthew Neely, Tommy Callahan on the other side of the glass. We're talking to Dr. Cyril Weck, and we're talking about his book that came out in the last couple of months. Basically, it's his memoirs of being a pathologist on a lot of key cases out there, a lot of other cases too, ones people that you might have not heard of. We were just talking about it, Dr. Weck. So basically, you're a Pennsylvania guy, and is it from your work earlier on the JFK, RFK stuff, that all of a sudden you were on the speed dial of a lot of people when it came to this? Is that how that happened?
Yes, I would say so. I don't do any advertising or anything. But I guess that's right. Once I got started, then I began to speak, and I guess people felt that I had something to offer as a forensic pathologist, and I could address these matters in an articulate fashion. So, you know, I got contacted. Sometimes there would be national television programs, like with Elvis Presley. I was contacted by ABC's 2020. Other times it'll be a governmental agency. Sometimes it'll be the family. So it has varied over the years.
So Elvis is actually dead, is what you're telling me?
Yes, he is dead.
What?
He's not living on Corsica or Crete there in the Mediterranean Sea. I wish that he were. What a great voice.
I could have sworn I saw him at Burger King.
But you know, just look at Elvis Presley. You asked me before about what is it in second autopsies or review of autopsies. Most of these cases, I don't have the opportunity to do the second autopsy, but of course, I review the autopsy and I ask for microscopic slides and so on. The medical examiner, Jerry Francisco, there in Tennessee, ruled that it was not his case. Nevertheless, the family has an autopsy done privately by a pathologist at the Baptist Memorial Hospital in Memphis. Francisco goes there, he doesn't do the autopsy, and yet before the body is even sewn up, and obviously before microscopic slides are studied and toxicological results have been obtained, he is announcing to the world that Elvis Presley died from an enlarged heart. Elvis Presley had a minimally enlarged heart of no great moment. He was a very large man. What Elvis Presley died from were 11 central nervous system drugs, which good old Dr. Nicopoulos, the sycophantic doctor who lived there, I think, at Graceland, anything Elvis wanted, the good old Dr. Nick prescribed. But there's a classic example of how a case can be covered up, how a case can be subverted for different reasons, different cases, and how a second review can be extremely important in making sure that the truth is revealed.
Which one of these cases that you've worked on to this day, you feel like, you know, you found out how they really died, but the rest of the world, other than the JFK one, what's one of those cases that to this day still drives you crazy that the narrative has gone on that someone we kind of heard, well, we've heard of died, but it didn't happen that way?
All right, I'll give it to you. RFK, gentlemen, you're both intelligent guys and you're up on the news. You weren't around, I guess, in 1968, or maybe as adults, but you recall the case and you studied it and so on. So you remember, for the background setting, Robert Kennedy has just won the California primary, which is tantamount to getting the Democratic nomination for president. They don't want to take him out through the ballroom because they'll never make it for hours with his adoring crowd. They take him out through the kitchen area of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. And he's walking out there, right? Remember? And then Sirhan Sirhan, who is there, and Sirhan shoots him. As the senator approaches, Sirhan shoots. What do you recall? What do you think was the distance of Sirhan Sirhan with hand and gun when he shot at Robert Kennedy?
So I just feel like it's pretty close, is what I feel like.
Well, then you're smarter than most people. Most people say 10 feet, 8 feet, 6 feet. Of course, I don't know what you mean by pretty close. Are you ready for this? The shot that killed Senator Kennedy, fired above and behind his right ear, was fired from 1 to 1.5 inches away from the senator's head with a slightly forward direction. 1 to 1.5 inches above and behind the right ear. Now, did that ever come out in the trial? No. The prosecution obviously wasn't going to ask it because there's no way in the world that Sirhan was ever that close and slightly behind the senator. And on cross-examination, even though there's an experienced defense attorney, he never asked Dr. Noguchi, my friend and colleague, the chief medical examiner at LA who did the autopsy. They never asked him either. And there it is in the autopsy report. Go and check. Signed off on by a dozen forensic pathologists, including 3 military forensic pathologists, whom I suggested at the time when he woke me up in the middle of the night to get some ideas from me about how they could keep the senator's body from being taken illegally from him, as they had done with John Kennedy in Dallas. So there's another example.
So, Doctor, and, where did they say Sirhan Sirhan was when he killed him?
Well, it's not a matter of what they said. It's a matter of what everybody saw. Dozens of people right there. And there's all the photographic evidence as well as everybody was there. Sirhan was in front of the senator. The senator was walking toward him, and Sirhan stepped forward and shot. We all know that. There's no question. Sirhan was a shooter. Oh, I want to make that clear. He indeed was a shooter. The point is there was a second shooter directly behind the senator, whether it was Eugene St. Cesar, a private guard, who took out his gun and shot, and it was just a terrible mistake, or whether it was something that was designed and planned in conspiratorial fashion. I don't know for sure. I have my private thoughts, but I'm trying to deal with hard facts. And then talking about the Kennedys, to show you how the system can be perverted, it's like Mary Jo Kopechne with Senator Ted Kennedy, is a medical examiner in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the first state in the country to adopt a so-called top-level appointed medical examiner system. And he is there at the scene. A young woman found in a car submerged in Poca Pond at Chappaquiddick, and he makes the incredible decision that it is not necessary to do an autopsy. Not necessary to do an autopsy. So I was consulted by the DA of Suffolk County, Boston. I testified in Luzerne County, that's Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, where the body was buried, her parents lived, in an attempt to get the body exhumed for an autopsy. And while the judge agreed and wanted to do it, the family vehemently protested. And so an autopsy was never done. So whether there was anything more involved or not, I don't know. Again, I have my own thoughts. But the point is that this is what happens with the system. And sometimes people just come up with a ruling that I disagree with, that is subject to interpretation. Rebecca Zahal, a 33-year-old beautiful Asian woman there in San Diego living in the Spreckles Mansion. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, we've got to go to break. So I don't know. Do you want to do another segment or you got to go?
I can do one more segment, gentlemen.
All right, let's do another segment. Thank you. We're hanging out with Dr. Cyril Wecht, the Life and Deaths of Cyril Wecht, Memoirs of America's Most Controversial Forensic Pathologist. Hey now, dedicated to Mayor of Tucson, Rahina Romero. We are hanging out with Matt Neely, but we've been imposing for an extra segment on Dr. Cyril Wecht and his talking about his new book. Dr. Wecht, one of our listeners said, great interview. I've already bought the book, so it's working.
Thank you. Maybe a multimillionaire listener will say, great book. I want to invite Dr. Wecht and his wife to come out and spend a weekend in Tucson.
We can do that.
And get away get away from that cold weather out there in Pittsburgh.
Amen. So you were also consulted on the JonBenet Ramsey case.
Yes.
What did
I spent a lot of time on that case. Well, I'll start off by telling you that the so-called intruder who came into the house and killed JonBenet Ramsey, he will be found when I am essentially devoid of hair on top of my head, is next scene with hair down to my waist like Troy Polamalu, the great Pittsburgh Steeler back. That's when the intruder will be found. JonBenet Ramsey, 6-year-old beauty queen, who was not there in the house. Her mother got up in the morning, the day after Christmas, to make breakfast. The family was going to go off to their home in Michigan for the Christmas holiday. And she sees leaning up against a stair on a back set a paper that says, we represent a small foreign faction, blah, 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 and making a ransom demand. She searches the house quickly, wakes her husband up, no JonBenet Ramsey there. They call the cops. They come. They look through the house, and they don't find her. John, the father, invites his then-best friend, soon to become his worst enemy, multimillionaire Fleet White over, along with the minister and their wives, and they're sitting around, and then John Ramsey says to Fleet White, let's go look again. Takes him downstairs, and there's a room, and keep in mind, while it's a large house, many of your listeners are living in larger houses, okay? And that room is so obscure that the homicide detectives looking for a human body do not even know that there is a room. John Ramsey opens up the door, turns on the light. According to Fleet White later on, before the eyes could even become adjusted, after the switch is on, is exclaiming, oh my God, there she is. And there was JonBenet Ramsey under a blanket. So then the autopsy is done, and the autopsy interestingly reveals a focal chronic inflammation in the vaginal area, a focal superficial erosion of the 7 o'clock position. I'll leave that to the women who are listening, thinking of the last gynecological examination with the gynecologist examining them. 7 o'clock position, that's the forefinger of the gynecologist examining the vaginal vault for lesions and so on. There's focal erosion there. And then she has a 7.5-inch fracture of her head from front to back with only 7 cc's of blood. 7 cc's is 1.5 teaspoons. If somebody comes in and cracks either one of you on your heads, and you guys probably have hair, you're going to have a lot more than 7 cc's. Many, much, much more bleeding because you don't die right away. Bleeding continues. You die eventually because of the massive pressure intracranially, and that's why the neurosurgeons go in and remove the blood to take away that pressure. So that blow was inflicted while she was dead or dying to make it appear that this had been a brutal slaying. Back to the ransom note then. What was the ransom demand? Either one of you ever done a kidnapping? What would you have asked if you kidnapped a little girl of a multimillionaire? $100,000, $250,000, $500,000? How about $118,000? $118,000, which was exactly the amount that John Ramsey had received as a bonus from his company the year before. We represent a small foreign faction, and that's what we want. And then he does all of that, and he leaves the house as he had entered it without awakening anybody. When he came in, he knew where the little girl's bedroom was, got her without awakening her or her brother, Bert, 3 years older, next door bedroom. He knows about the back set of stairs. He knows about that room in the basement, which the cops don't even know is there. And then he leaves. He made one mistake. One mistake is incredibly brave, horrible monster that he is, but a pretty adroit, clever guy, and he leaves, and he forgets one thing. And you know what that is, and I love to do this with audiences, and people stare at me, what is it? He leaves the body. He just wrote the ransom note.
That he's demanding ransom for, sure.
Yeah, 45-pound package. He can't carry 45-pound package, throw it into his car, drop it in the sewer or in the river, and he leaves the body. How do you like that? That is the JonBenet Ramsey case. And reminding me then of leaving the body is like in the James Earl Ray case with Martin Luther King, which I spent a lot of time on and dealing with too. that James Earl Ray, who's been out of prison successfully for the first time after some absurd escapes, he's been living for a year in Mexico. He comes up to Memphis. He knows exactly where to go in a rooming house and walk the end of the hall, the community bathroom, opens up the transom, and he will be facing the back porch of the Lorraine Motel where King is staying, having gone to Memphis to settle a refuse workers' strike. And he shoots Dr. King, and then he leaves. And he says, you know what? How in the hell is anybody ever going to know that it was me? That's not fair. I got to give them some lead. And so he drops his rifle with his fingerprints. You don't take the rifle in your car. Don't throw it in a sewer or in a river or just take it with you on your way to Canada. I'll leave the rifle with my fingerprints. That's the James Earl Ray Martin Luther King case. You like that?
So
there you are. People say, how can it be? I know people are incredulous. They're incredulous. But everything I've given you, believe me, I haven't misstated any facts.
Are we saying that James Earl Ray didn't kill MLK?
Yes, that's what I'm saying, yes.
So who might have killed JFK? MLK.
Okay. Well, I can't tell you that. I don't know the identity of the people who killed Kennedy or King. Maybe I wouldn't be alive today if I did. I've paid a price for knowing as much as I have and expressing it as I am doing with you gentlemen this morning. But I guess because I don't know who did it, and they're all dead by now anyway. But that's the story. I attended the autopsy on James Earl Ray and worked it with the medical examiner. I don't know. I have my thoughts.
So if he didn't die from... Okay, let me rephrase the question. If he didn't die from the bullet from James Earl Ray, how did he truly die?
Well, he died. He died from the bullet that was fired that entered just below his jaw and went up into his face. He died from that. There's no question about how he died.
Right.
The question is who did the shooting. That's the point. Yeah, that's
gotcha.
The point.
People
sometimes say, "I'm sorry, go ahead."
No, keep going. I'm sorry. I got a couple more minutes with you. Let's go to O.J. Simpson. What was that? That's another high profile.
I think O.J. Simpson. Yeah, I was consulted by Johnny Cochran, Lee Bailey, and the Dream Team in that case. And Lee Bailey, an old friend, came a couple of days at my house in Pittsburgh and reviewed everything. I wound up not testifying because I had spoken out so much on television. And my good friend and colleague, Dr. Michael Budden, did a great job as a forensic pathologist, and Dr. Henry Lee, another great colleague, as a criminalist. I believe that O.J. Simpson was definitely present, but there had to be a second person. 17 wounds on one person, 22 wounds on another. Carotid arteries, jugular veins severed in the neck. The blood spurts for feet. If somebody came in right now and slashed your throat, the blood would spatter 3 feet, 4 feet away from you onto the walls. So where's all that blood? They went back to O.J.'s house, shower, toilet, bathtub, sink. No blood at all. One drop of blood on a sock, which was planted, shown to have anticoagulant, which is present in the tube when blood is drawn at your doctor's office, not present in your body. So where is it? The clothing, all the blood, the instrument. There was a second person, and I believe it was his son, Jason. There was a violent argument when Jason got there. And the background was that she was supposed to have gone to the restaurant where Jason worked to celebrate her birthday or something, and she went somewhere else, and he was angry, and he went there to the scene. Now, some of this is subjective, but what I just told you about the gunshot wounds and all the bleeding, those are hard facts. So that's the O.J. Simpson case, and he got off because of the fact that Mark Furman, the lead detective, had used the N-word, which Lee Bailey brought out in a brilliant cross-examination, and 9 African-Americans on the jury did not like that, and I can understand, and I agree with them. I'm Jewish. If I were sitting on a panel and they brought in as their key witness an anti-Semite who has made remarks about Jews, I would go into the jury room and say to myself, screw him. I don't care about justice. If this is what the prosecution is presenting, and that's what happened, and that's why he was acquitted. And he got nailed in a civil case for $33 million, which no big deal at that time. He did wind up going to jail on some totally unrelated matter of a cockamamie nature in Nevada. So that's the O.J. Simpson case.
If you want to find out more, get the book. It's called Life, The Life and Deaths of Cyril Wecht. Memoirs of America's Most Controversial Forensic Pathologist. Well, Dr. Wecht, we could talk to you for 3 hours, but we got to
go. Well, Chris and Matthew, I thank you. And my pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you. I wish all of you and your listeners a very wonderful holiday season, Hanukkah and Christmas and New Year's, and the best. And maybe we'll be with you guys again sometime down the road. Thanks a lot.
Love to do it again. All right. You're on the Wake Up Tucson show, 1030 The Voice, local news and talk. Oh, my gosh. Hey, welcome back to the Wake Up Tucson show. Little Brittany overprotected. So perfect. Thank you very much.
It's her birthday, I think.
It is. Happy birthday,
Brittany.
Your
screen.
How old's Brittany?
I have no idea. 30 something.
In conservatorship and the whole bit.
So anyway, poor girl.
39. She's 39. I just saw it. So Britney Spears is 39 years old today. And, of course, overprotected. Thank God the mayor's here.
Nice
to help
tie
us. So that was another good one, Tom. Very
hey,
nice.
The double whammy birthday in the curfew.
Total double whammy.
So let's just talk about Dr. Wecht for a second.
Wow.
So many questions. I'm still stuck on the RFK thing. Like, did the caliber of the bullet that was shot behind him match the .22 that Sirhan used? And maybe,
right.
Maybe that one. I didn't circle back with that one, but
I mean, because if Sirhan was in front, and then he said that he was shot behind his ear, so that means one of his own guys killed him either by accident or on purpose. So that's interesting. All right. And what was so great is all I had to do was say a name with him, and he just goes off. Right.
Yes.
I didn't even have to like formulate a question. Right. And you know, what about JonBenet? Let me tell you about JonBenet Ramsey. And he was pissed off. Of all of those ones we just heard,
struck a nerve.
That one struck a nerve with him.
Yeah. And probably because she was so young.
Sure.
Yep.
But also that the idea that, you know, he's saying that basically the father and I think it's kind of intimating that the father and Fleet White there were whatever was going on, you know, and then the idea of the ransom note, but
they didn't take their collateral with them.
Right.
Usually if you're, you know. Even in Fargo, they took the guy's wife, you know.
And the $118,000.
Very specific.
That's crazy. Why the? I mean, it was, why? Even if JonBenet Ramsey's dad really did that, why would you choose last year's Christmas bonus? Right?
Right.
That's a hell of a bonus, too. $118,000. That's like Huckleberry numbers. and then, did he just say on the air that?
He did.
What did he say on the air?
He said that O.J. Simpson's son, he said it, I'm not just paraphrasing what we just heard, that O.J. Simpson's son was there and part of the murders of Nicole Brown Simpson and Mr. Goldman.
Yep.
Goldman, yeah. Ron Goldman's
Nolan.
Father. So.
Right.
Yep.
Holy crap.
You heard it here first. Wake up, Tucson.
We just did JFK.
Yeah.
Right? And so when he's going through it, because he's done it so many times, the magic bullet thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yep.
And then I'm thinking, well, there's two magic bullets. It's right. It, well, I either think of Seinfeld with the magic spitter.
Sure,
right?
Of course.
Or
parody. Right? The magic loogie, right?
All right, the magic loogie. Thank you very much. Or the JFK movie.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And as they're doing that whole thing, I'm sitting there going, and then I remembered that Cyril consulted on the Oliver Stone movie JFK.
Mm-hmm.
So that made like total sense that Cyril was doing exactly what Garrison was doing. And he talked about how he worked with Garrison after that whole thing and the Clay Shaw, because that's a key figure in this whole, in the movie and things like that. So who knew we were going to get that today?
So I don't think I've ever heard O.J. Simpson's son be implicated or intimated or anything like that in this whole thing. And we heard it here.
Well, it's interesting because in my brain, you know who I'm thinking as he says there's a second killer is Al Cowlings.
Sure.
Right? That's who I'm thinking. I'm thinking he's going to say maybe it's Al Cowlings, right? And then he says Jason Simpson. And I'm like, what?
Wow.
So.
What? Really, really something. Yeah.
We'll have to clip that sucker.
Wow.
I mean, it's the first time we ever heard that on the air of Jason Simpson's and the second killer.
One thing that was interesting, I didn't realize Thomas Noguchi went as far back as RFK's assassination.
Right.
But what is interesting is he was so key in the O.J. Simpson investigation, and he referred to him, the RFK thing, as my good friend Thomas Noguchi, but he didn't talk about having talked to him as part of the O.J. Trial. Now, I realize the defense attorneys contacted him, and that's who his conversations were with, but
right.
He didn't really have anything to add to if he had ever talked to Thomas Noguchi about any of these theories.
Yeah, just wild stuff. Check out the book. The last name is Wecht.
Very interesting.
W-E-C-H-T. And like I said, Dr. Van Nostrand, Dr. Van Buren, who's going to be doing, in honor of Tom on Friday, he's going to be doing top 10 movies that have to do with winter sports. Because we weren't sure we can find top 10 movies about hockey. So we expanded it to ice skating and skiing. So, Mark, who does our movies, Tom, he's coming on Friday.
Okay.
He wanted to do top 10 hockey movies for you.
Okay.
We couldn't find, he didn't know if he could find 10 that were really unbelievable. So we're doing it hockey and other winter sports movies coming up on Friday.
All right, that's fair.
So, for all you cutting edge fans, so you got a shot.
Do I get a chance to put together my own list?
Of course, there if you want. Sure.
Okay, very good.
Please contribute.
Yes. All right.
Maybe there's a couple movies about lugeing in there that that Mark can add into the mix.
No, but I believe there will be a bobsled sighting.
Yeah, oh, there you go.
It sounds like Dr. Evil when he's talking about his childhood. You know, it was typical luge lessons. So Campus Reform had a story about our beloved University of Arizona. And no, it wasn't unnamed memos sent to people. It was... I love this. So he, on the 19th anniversary of 9/11, U of A undergrad Jacob Orsay created a school-approved outdoor memorial on campus with several friends. After finishing, they removed their masks to take a picture. So then they got, 3 days later, the email from the dean of students stating he had violated the code of conduct by posting, quote, negative views regarding the COVID-19 protocols of the University of Arizona, unquote. Also, regarding the COVID-19 health and safety protocols, unquote. The email separately stated that the dean of students also reviewed the September 11th photograph that allegedly shows Jacob not in compliance with the health and safety policies. What else do we got here? The email said such behavior violates the student code of conduct in the area of, quote, endangering, threatening, and causing harm to any member of the university community. Hmm. Orsay had previously responded. He says it's less than 10 people. This is his comment on a Reddit about this. It's less than 10 people. Chill out, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
He spoke to the university on the
19th. That was the comment that got him in trouble.
Okay. So he said it's less than 10 people. Chill out. Okay. He said that he was also forced to explain a group message that previously created was a joke meant to criticize the university's COVID policy. So he would receive a COVID-19 monetary sanction of $250 and also forced, I love this, a... I love that they have this, quote, a personal responsibility workshop.
That'll teach him.
Unquote, for additional $90. So anyway, he was placed on probation, not Huckleberry triple secret probation, not just that. Regular probation.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, by the time it was all over, they had to back off.
Mm-hmm.
By the time it was all over, they were contacted by aftercampusreform.com contacted the university to talk to because they want to do a story about it. Magically, the University of Arizona dropped all sanctions against the student. So they were that proud of it, as we like to say. They were that proud of their actions.
Open discussion of ideas and that whole thing. Yeah.
All right. So when we come back, Matt and I got a lot to cover when we come back after the top of the hour. One of our interviews in the third hour will be John Riches from the Goldwater Institute. They filed a lawsuit against the state of Arizona on the unconstitutionality, I think I said that right, of Proposition 208, which was the Red for Ed education tax increase in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see where we're going with that. And then Matt, you have a folder.
I got a few things.
So we got, Matt's got, like Deb Fern says, I got issues. He's got an issues folder that we need to get into really, really quick. So remember, we're sending Ed Alexander his retirement trip to Italy. Please go to GoFundMe.com, put in Ed Alexander retirement trip Italy. And if you can give $10, some of you are taking the $37 that would have gone to the party and giving it to Ed for his trip. That's a good thing, too. So wake up, Tucson. 10:30, it's Matt Neely, Christy Simone, and you. And Tom Callahan. Bye-bye.